This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Happier at Home. Kiss more, jump more, abandon a project, read Samuel Johnson, and my other experiments in the practice of everyday life. This is the author, Gretchen Rubin. For Elizabeth. To be happy at home is the ultimate result of all ambition, the end to which every enterprise and labor tends. Samuel Johnson, The Rambler, number 68. Safe, 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 the heart of the house beats proudly. Long years, he sighs, again you found me. Here, she murmurs, sleeping, in the garden reading, laughing, rolling apples in the loft. Here we left our treasure. Stooping, their light lifts the lids upon my eyes. Safe, 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 the pulse of the house beats wildly. Waking, I cry, oh, is this your buried treasure? The light in the heart. Virginia Woolf, A Haunted House. A note to the listener. A happiness project is an approach to the practice of everyday life. First is the preparation stage, when you identify what brings you joy, satisfaction, and engagement, and also what brings you guilt, anger, boredom, and remorse. Second is the making of resolutions, when you identify the concrete actions that will boost your happiness. Then comes the interesting part, keeping your resolutions. Happier at Home is the story of my second happiness project, what I tried, what I learned. In the 5 years since my first happiness project, people have pressed, but did your project really make a difference? Your life didn't change much. How much happier can you be? It's true, my life has remained the same. The same husband and two daughters, the same work, the same apartment, the same daily routine. Nevertheless, my happiness project really did heighten my happiness. When I made the changes I knew I ought to make and followed my personal commandment to be Gretchen, I was able to change my life without changing my life. I can't start a happiness project, you might protest. I don't have any extra time or extra money or extra energy. I can't add one more item to my to-do list. But for the most part, my happiness project doesn't require much time, or much money, or even much energy. It takes work to be happier, but it's gratifying work. The real challenge is to decide purposely what to do, and then to do it. Why, I often wonder, is it difficult to push myself to do the things that bring happiness? So often, I know what resolutions would make me happier. But still, I have to prod myself to do them. Every day I struggle to give a kiss, to get enough sleep, to stop checking my email, to give gold stars. Every day I remind myself to accept myself and expect more from myself. My first happiness project was broad. Happier at Home is narrower and deeper. Because I realized that of the many elements that influenced my happiness, my home, in all its aspects, was most important, I decided to take some time to concentrate my efforts there. This is the account of the strategies I used to feel more at home. Of course, because this is my happiness project, it reflects my particular circumstances, values, interests, and temperament. Everyone's idea of home or happiness is unique, but it's the rare person who can't benefit from a happiness project. Well, you might think, if everyone's happiness project is unique, why should I bother to read about her project? My study of happiness taught me that, perhaps surprisingly, I tend to learn more from one person's highly idiosyncratic experiences than I do from sweeping philosophies or wide-ranging research. It's from the experience of a particular individual that I learn most about myself, even if we two seem to have nothing in common. Some of my own best guides, it happens, continue to be an argumentative, procrastinating lexicographer, a nun who spent more than a third of her short life in a cloistered convent, and one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence. This book is the story of an education. I hope that listening to my happiness project will encourage you to start your own. Whenever you read this, and wherever you are in the right place to begin. Preparation. The true secret of happiness lies in the taking a genuine interest in all the details of daily life. William Morris, The Aims of Art. One late summer Sunday evening, as I was unloading the dishwasher, I felt overwhelmed by a familiar but surprising emotion. I was hit by an intense wave of homesickness. Homesick? Why? Perhaps the hint of some scent or the quality of the light had triggered a long-forgotten memory. Homesick? For what? I didn't know. Yet even though I stood in my own kitchen with my family in the next room, where Jamie watched golf on television while Eliza and Eleanor played restaurant, suddenly I missed them terribly. I looked around me at the blue stove, the wooden knife rack, the broken toaster, the view from the window, all so familiar that usually I forgot to notice them. "May I offer you some dessert this evening?" I could hear Eleanor asking in her best waitress voice. "We have apple, blueberry, and pumpkin pie." I glanced into the next room where I could see the tops of the girls' heads. As usual, they were both wearing their straight brown hair in long, messy ponytails, and Eleanor sported a crooked waitress cap. "Blueberry, thank you," Eliza answered primly. "What about me?" Jamie asked. "Isn't the waitress going to take my order?" "No, Daddy, you're not in the game." What was this yearning I felt? I was homesick, I realized, with a prospective nostalgia for now and here, when Jamie and I live with our two girls under our roof, with our own parents strong and busy, with two little nephews just learning to talk and play, everyone healthy despite a few long-standing nagging medical concerns, and no disaster looming except the woes of sixth grade. A line from the British literary giant Samuel Johnson floated through my mind. "My life differs in practically every way from that of Dr. Johnson, the 18th century dictionary-writing eccentric genius. Yet whenever I read Johnson, I understand myself better." Johnson wrote, "To be happy at home is the ultimate result of all ambition, the end to which every enterprise and labor tends." That's true, I reflected, pausing for a moment to think before starting again, absentmindedly, to put away the dishes. Johnson was right. Home was at the center of my life, for good and for ill. But what was home, anyway? What did I want from my home? Home is where I walk through the door without ringing the bell, where I take a handful of coins from the change bowl without asking, where I eat a tuna fish sandwich without misgivings about the ingredients, where I rifle through the mail. At the heart of this home is my family. Where my family is home. If I lived by myself, home would be the place peopled with reminders of everyone I loved. My home is a place of unconditional belonging, which is part of its pleasure, part of its pain. As Robert Frost wrote, home is something you somehow haven't to deserve. At home, I feel a greater sense of safety and acceptance, and also of responsibility and obligation. With friends, my hospitality is voluntary, but my family never needs an invitation. Although the people in it are its most important element, home is also a place of return, the physical hub of my schedule and of my imagination. In my mind, the entire globe revolves around a single spot where a bright red "You are here" arrow hovers undetected above our roof. When Jamie and I moved from our old apartment just 10 blocks south to where we live now, I remember how all of New York City seemed to wobble and reorient itself just slightly to put us back at the very center. Behind our unremarkable front door waits the little world of our own making, a place of safety, exploration, comfort, and love. The dry scent of the coat closet, the faint clankings from the service elevator, the sight of our library books lined up by the front door, the flavor of the toothpaste we all share. This is my foundation. Why have I never thought about home before? I asked myself. Suddenly, the idea of home exploded in my mind. Home, I exulted as I put the last mug on the shelf. I'll start another happiness project, and this time I'll focus on home. My mind began to race with ideas. I'd done a happiness project before, when for 1 year I tackled many aspects of my life to try to boost my happiness. They say that research is me-search, and that the best way to learn a subject is to write a book about it. I'd undertaken my first happiness project for just those reasons. In particular, I'd realized that although I possessed all the elements of a happy life, too often I took my circumstances for granted and allowed myself to become overly vexed by petty annoyances or fleeting worries. I'd wanted to appreciate my life more and to live up to it better. To address my aims systematically, I devised a plan. 12 months, each month dedicated to one theme. Friendship, work, eternity, and so on. With each theme accompanied by a handful of modest resolutions. My plodding, methodical, and arguably excessive approach to happiness struck some people, such as Jamie, as a bit comical. But it suited me. And although I love hearing about other people's radical happiness projects, such as Henry David Thoreau moving to Walden Pond or Elizabeth Gilbert traveling to Indonesia, I'd aim to find more happiness within my daily routine. I'm not an adventurous soul. I eat the same food every day and rarely stray from my neighborhood, and my idea of living on the edge is to leave the apartment without a sweater. And anyway, even if I'd wanted a big adventure happiness project, I don't think I could have pulled it off. For me to leave town, even for one weekend, requires a NASA-level amount of advanced logistical planning. Given my two young children, my work, my husband, my multiplying to-do lists, and my homebody nature, a move to Paris or a trek up Mount Kilimanjaro wouldn't have suited me. Instead, I'd set out to find greater happiness within my everyday life. In my first project, I'd worked out many general theories of happiness. For this project, I would build on what I'd learned. I foresaw an ambitious scheme covering all the elements that mattered for home, such as relationships, possessions, time, body, neighborhood. And I definitely replace our dud toaster. I closed the dishwasher, grabbed a handy Hello Kitty notepad and pen, and sat down to take notes on which resolutions to undertake. I wouldn't wait for January to pursue a list of new resolutions, I determined immediately. Instead, I'd begin next month, in September. After all, September 2 marked the start of a new year, with the empty calendar and clean slate of the next school cycle. Even though I was no longer in school myself, September nevertheless remained charged with possibility and renewal. Each year, Labor Day was a milestone that provoked my self-evaluation and reflection, just as New Year's Day, various major birthdays, high school and college reunions, and the publications of my books did. These days, September was also the season of the Mother Olympics, with all the health forms, supply lists, and emergency contact sheets. I could barely keep track of everything I had to buy, fill out, or turn in. This September marked two particular milestones for our family. 5-year-old Eleanor would start kindergarten, and the era of finger painting, strollers, and noon dismissal would end forever. At the same time, 11-year-old Eliza would enter 6th grade, the year that often marks the beginning of teenage drama. Her childhood was drawing to a close. It seemed a good time to reevaluate my life. For the 9 months of the school year, from September through May, I vowed I'd strive to make home more homey. First, I'd address some basic tasks. I should make sure that we had some working flashlights and a fire extinguisher under the kitchen sink, and it was probably time to spring for a new toilet plunger. Beyond those rudimentary steps, however, what should I do? In perhaps the most famous first line of any novel, Leo Tolstoy wrote, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." Whether or not this sweeping statement is true, it suggests that happy families share certain elements. How could I cultivate these elements in my own family, in my own home? That was my central question. One important lesson from my first happiness project was to recognize how happy I already am. As life goes wheeling along, I find it too easy to take my everyday happiness for granted and to forget what really matters. I've long been haunted by a remark by the writer Colette. What a wonderful life I've had. I only wish I'd realized it sooner. I didn't want to look back at the end of my life or after some great catastrophe and think, then we were so happy, if only we'd realized it. I had everything that I could wish for. I wanted to make my home happier by appreciating how much happiness was already there. As I thought about this new happiness project, I realized that unless I restricted my innovations to my own bedroom closet, Jamie, Eliza, and Eleanor would be swept along with me. My home was their home, and whatever I did would affect them deeply. But although I cared immensely about their happiness, I felt certain that I should focus on resolutions that I would follow. While I might enjoy giving them assignments to make them, and also me, happier, in the end, I could change no one but myself. Fortunately, I thought, a Gretchen-centered approach to a happier home would surely make Jamie, Eliza, and Eleanor happier too. But as ideas flooded my mind, I warned myself not to pursue any resolutions that would directly conflict with their happiness. My desire for more affectionate gestures shouldn't become a focus of nagging, and my clutter-clearing zeal couldn't justify a sneak purge of Eliza's dusty stuffed animals or Jamie's teetering bedside book stack. A guiding principle for all who undertake a happiness project is, first, do no harm. Along the same lines, I must guard against becoming the happiness project version of Charles Dickens's Mrs. Jellyby, pursuing happiness at the expense of my happiness. As I scribbled notes at top speed, Jamie walked into the kitchen and headed straight for the chocolate cake he'd baked with the girls that afternoon. "Listen," I said excitedly. I waved the paper in front of him as he cut himself a generous piece. "I just had the greatest idea. I'm going to do another happiness project." "Another one?" he asked. "Yes, I got the idea from Dr. Johnson. He wrote, 'To be happy at home is the ultimate result of all ambition.' I think that's true, don't you?" "Sure," he smiled. "Everyone wants to be happy at home." "But aren't you already happy at home?" "Yes, of course," I said. "But I could be happier." "How could you be happier? You already have the perfect husband." "That's right," I shot him a fond look. "Still, I could be happier. We could all be happier." "The thing is," he said more seriously and with a mouthful of cake, "you've already done all that happiness stuff." He waved his fork around the room. "You know, all those resolutions." "The first happiness project worked so well. I want to do another one." "Oh, okay." Jamie retreated to the television with his plate. I didn't mind his lack of curiosity. After all, I was doing this happiness project for myself, and it was bound to make him happier too. I bent over my paper once more. Over the next several weeks, as I planned my project, I kept confronting many of the paradoxes of happiness that I'd learned during my earlier research. Accept myself and expect more of myself. Give myself limits to give myself freedom. Make people happier by acknowledging that they're not feeling happy. Plan ahead to be spontaneous. Only with careful preparation do I feel carefree. Accomplish more by working less. Happiness doesn't always make me feel happy. Flawed can be more perfect than perfection. It's very hard to make things easier. My material desires have a spiritual aspect. Hell is other people. Heaven is other people. Certainly I had paradoxical wishes for my home. Frank Lloyd Wright wrote, "A true home is the finest ideal of man, and the challenge lay in that word, true. What would be true for me? My home should calm me and energize me. It should be a comforting, quiet refuge and a place of excitement and possibility. It should call to my mind the past, the present, and the future. It should be a snuggery of privacy and reflection, but also a gathering place that strengthened my engagement with other people. By making me feel safe, it should embolden me to take risks. I wanted a feeling of home so strong that no matter where I went, I would take that feeling with me. At the same time, I wanted to find adventure without leaving my apartment. My home should suit me, and also suit Jamie, Eliza, and Eleanor. But as I considered this list, I saw that these weren't, in fact, contradictory desires. My home could be both wading pool and diving board. I knew that with my home, as with everything that touched my happiness, I could build a happy life only on the foundation of my own nature. It had been a huge relief to me when, quite recently, I'd finally realized that the style of my apartment and my clothes and my music didn't have to reflect the true me. Messages like, "Your home is a direct representation of your soul," and "Every choice shows the world the real you," paralyzed me. What did my choice of throw pillows reflect about my character? Was I the kind of person who would paint a room purple? What was my real taste? I had no idea. My anxiety to do things right sometimes made me forget what really mattered to me. Finally, I'd realized that our apartment didn't have to reveal any deep truths. I expressed myself in other ways. It was enough that my apartment was a pleasant, comfortable place to live and had miles of bookshelves. Some people, like my mother, get tremendous creative satisfaction from shaping the look of their homes. But I don't. I find it exhausting. In this area, I would be authentically inauthentic. In fact, studies suggest, we pay a price for authenticity. In a world so full of choices, when we choose deliberately among alternatives, we expend mental energy that then can't be used for other tasks. But while I'd stopped fretting about making an authentic choice of coffee table, I nevertheless recognized that a true home must suit the people who live there by incorporating the elements important to them. When a friend who lives in a beautiful townhouse told me that she'd added a sunroom, I couldn't help asking, "Didn't you have enough space already?" "It's not the space, it's the light," she said. "Because it's a townhouse, it only has windows at the front and back, and it's very dark all day long. My husband loves it, but I need a lot of sunshine, and I was always looking for excuses to leave the house during the day, because the lack of light made me uncomfortable. Now I'm so much happier at home." Friends with four children equipped a hallway with climbing ropes and bars. Animal-loving friends keep a beehive on their building's roof. A friend who lives alone celebrates his complete control of his space with delicately painted floors and white furniture. The key, as always, is mindfully to choose what's right for me and my family. Before I started, I asked myself, why bother to do another happiness project? Wasn't one enough? After all, I didn't need to organize a whole project if all I wanted was a working toaster. My first project had done so much to boost my happiness, however, that I hardly hesitated. Of everything I'd tried, the greatest benefit, greater than the benefit of imitating a spiritual master, or starting my children's literature reading groups, or even launching my blog, was my increased appreciation for the happiness I already possessed. True, last year Jamie had been flattened by a bad back, but it hadn't flared up again. My sister Elizabeth's type 1 diabetes was under control. My daughters didn't squabble much. Eleanor had finally outgrown her formidable tantrums. When my days were following their ordinary course, it was hard to remember what was truly important, and my happiness project helped charge my life with more gratitude and contentment. When I first started working on the subject of happiness, I worried that devoting so much energy to becoming happier might be selfish or pointless. After all, I had all the elements of a happy life. If I wanted to be happier, was I a spoiled brat? In a world so full of suffering, was it morally appropriate to seek to be happier? What was happiness anyway, and was it even possible to make myself happier? These questions no longer troubled me. Current research shows, and casual observation confirms, that some people are temperamentally more cheerful or gloomy than others, and that people's ideas and behavior also affect their happiness. About 30 to 50% of happiness is genetically determined. About 10 to 20% reflects life circumstances, such as age, gender, health, marital status, income, occupation. And the rest is very much influenced by the way we think and act. We possess considerable power to push ourselves to the top or bottom of our natural range through our conscious actions and thoughts. And although scientists and philosophers require precise definitions, happiness has some 15 academic definitions. I followed the novelists and essayists and gloried in the expansiveness of the term happiness. This sweeping word is wide enough to take in crumbs of meaning and allows me to argue paradoxes that, although not scientifically accurate, are nevertheless true, such as happiness doesn't always make me feel happy, and make people happier by acknowledging that they're unhappy. Not to mention that the term happiness is catchier than frequent positive affect or subjective well-being. I knew happiness when I felt it, and if other people's ideas of happiness were more focused on bliss or contentment or satisfaction or peace, well, the broad concept of happiness was big enough for all of us. While happiness might suggest a final magical destination, the aim of a happiness project isn't to hit 10 on the 1 to 10 happiness scale and to remain there perpetually. That would be neither realistic nor desirable. I sought not to achieve perfect happiness, but rather to become happier. Next week, next year, what can I do to be happier? At certain points in our lives, it may not be possible to be happy, but it is possible to try to be happier, as happy as we can be under the circumstances, and by doing so, fortify ourselves against adversity. Also, in my view, the opposite of happiness is unhappiness, not depression. Depression, a grave condition demanding urgent attention, occupies its own dark category, and addressing its causes and cures was far beyond the scope of my project. Nevertheless, even a person who isn't depressed, or even unhappy, can benefit from trying to be happier. Research shows that happiness is the cause and the effect of many desirable circumstances, such as a strong marriage, more friends, better health, success at work, including making more money, more energy, better self-control, and even longer life. Although people sometimes assume that the happy are self-absorbed and complacent, just the opposite is true. In general, happiness doesn't make people want to drink daiquiris on the beach. It makes them want to help rural villagers gain better access to clean water. I knew that when I was happier, I laughed more and yelled less. I stayed calmer when things went wrong, when Eleanor left a magic marker uncapped on a cushion, or when Eliza got a worrisome burn on her arm. As Oscar Wilde wrote, with his characteristic brand of thought-provoking overstatement, "When we are happy, we are always good. But when we are good, we are not always happy." Now, as I contemplated a happiness project centered on the idea of home, I faced a new question. Should the conditions of my life matter to my happiness at all? If my happiness were built on a sufficiently firm foundation, perhaps my serenity would remain unruffled by the sight of our messy kitchen counters or the sound of my daughter's bickering. But I didn't linger over that question. Although religions and philosophies instruct us to cultivate a happiness free from the influence of worldly circumstances, in my view, whether or not these circumstances should contribute to happiness, they clearly do for most people, and certainly for me. This area would get serious attention during my happiness project. Nevertheless, Although I wanted to embrace the power of home comforts to color my happiness, and I did think their influence was somewhat inescapable, I also sought to build a happiness independent from them. In my first happiness project, as I labored to identify the fundamental principles that underlay happiness, I'd identified four splendid truths. An unexpected side effect of studying happiness is now tireless enthusiasm for making numbered lists. Although I'd struggled mightily to articulate these truths, they're easy to summarize. To be happy, I need to think about feeling good, feeling bad, and feeling right in an atmosphere of growth. One of the best ways to make myself happy is to make other people happy. One of the best ways to make other people happy is to be happy myself. The days are long, but the years are short. I'm not happy unless I think I'm happy. To help me identify which new resolutions to tackle over the next 9 months, I consulted the four elements of the first splendid truth. First, how could I get more feeling good? More fun, more love, more energy. To be happy, it's not enough to eliminate the negative. I must also have sources of positive emotions. Also, because I'd gain the most happiness from a particular experience if I anticipated it, savored it as it unfolded, expressed happiness, and recalled the happy memory, I'd take steps to amplify my enjoyment of each of these four stages. Next, what sources of feeling bad could I eliminate? I would use negative feelings and painful pricks of conscience to spotlight areas ripe for change. For instance, I wanted to feel more connected to each member of my family and to create a calmer and more unhurried atmosphere for all of us. The third element, feeling right, is more elusive. Feeling right is about virtue, doing my duty, living up to my own standards, and also about living the life that's right for me, in occupation, location, family situation, and so on. Sometimes choosing to feel right means accepting some feeling bad. Happiness doesn't always make me feel happy. I dislike every step of dealing with yearly flu shots for my family, yet this chore also makes me happy. To feel right, I'd look for ways to make my home more closely reflect my values, to make sure that the life I'm living is the life I ought to be living. My ordinary routine should reflect the things most important to me. Although I'd initially underrated its value, the true significance of the fourth element, the atmosphere of growth, had become clearer to me over time. As William Butler Yeats wrote, "Happiness is neither virtue nor pleasure, nor this thing nor that, but simply growth. We are happy when we are growing." Research supports his observation. It's not goal attainment, but the process of striving after goals, that is, growth, that brings happiness. I wanted an atmosphere of growth to pervade my home. I'd make it more beautiful and functional, fix broken things, clear clutter, enlarge its scope, and become master of my own stuff. However, because the first splendid truth didn't supply any suggestions about what concrete, manageable resolutions I should follow, I needed to assign myself homework for homework. Unfortunately, while it's fun and easy to make a resolution, it's hard to keep a resolution. Something like 44% of Americans make New Year's resolutions. I always do. But about 80% of resolutions are abandoned by mid-February. Many people make and break the same resolution year after year. One key to sticking to a resolution, for me, is constantly to hold myself accountable. To keep my resolutions under constant review and to mark my progress, or lack thereof, I'd use the resolutions chart that I'd created for my first happiness project. On it, I tracked my resolutions against the days of the month. Modeled after Benjamin Franklin's virtues chart, where Franklin plotted the days of the week against the 13 virtues he aimed to cultivate, this chart held me accountable to myself. Knowing that I should do something wasn't the same thing as actually doing it. For instance, who emphasizes the importance of a healthy diet and exercise more than doctors? Yet almost half of doctors are overweight. Also, helpfully, the chart would force me to frame my resolutions as concrete actions, more easily scored than vague resolutions such as make my home more comfortable or have more fun with my children. But what should those concrete, specific actions be? For me, being happier at home wouldn't be a matter of hanging more pictures or replacing that kitchen table I'd never liked. Mindfulness and self-knowledge would be more important than errands and expense. I wanted to put into practice William Morris's precept, "The true secret of happiness lies in the taking a genuine interest in all the details of daily life." Starting in September, September is the other January, I was ready to make a school year's worth of resolutions. But what 9 areas should I tackle? Ancient philosophers and contemporary scientists agree that a key, likely the key, to happiness is having strong ties to other people. And my relationships with Jamie, Eliza, and Eleanor, and my extended family, stood at the center of my home. I resolved to address marriage, parenthood, and family. A sense of personal control is a very important element to happiness. For instance, it's a much better predictor of happiness than income. At home, my sense of control over my stuff played a huge role in my happiness, as did a feeling of control over my time. So I added possessions and time. My happiness depended a great deal on my inner attitudes, so I added interior design, the inward reflection rather than Shelter Magazine brand of interior design. At the same time, I knew that my physical experience influenced my emotional experience, so I added body. What else? The place of my home in the world was important, so I added neighborhood. For the very last month of the school year, I wanted to concentrate on my third splendid truth. The days are long, but the years are short. This happiness truth has particular poignancy in my family life because my daughter's childhoods were slipping by so quickly. I wanted to remember now. During the time that I was plotting my resolutions for the next 9 months, I took Eleanor to a 5-year-old's birthday party. While the children chased around, and I tried to resist dipping into the bowl of chocolate-covered pretzels, another mother and I struck up a conversation about our work. With one eye on Eleanor, who was showing more courage than skill on the balance beam, I mentioned a few of my planned resolutions. My new acquaintance said doubtfully, "You make happiness sound like a lot of effort. I study Buddhism, and meditation has changed my life. Do you meditate?" I was a bit touchy about my failure to try meditation. Did the fact that I couldn't bring myself to try it even once mean that I was utterly soulless? Actually, no, I admitted. "You should. It's essential. I go crazy if I don't meditate for at least 30 minutes each day." Uncertain as to whether this declaration was the sign of a well-regulated mind or just the opposite, I replied, "Well, my way is to concentrate more on changing my actions than on changing my mental state. I think you'll find that cultivating inner calm is much more important than worrying about accomplishing a lot of little tasks. You really must meditate if you're going to say anything about happiness." I answered, trying to sound noncommittal. Then, perhaps too pointedly, I remarked, "I often remind myself that just because something makes me happy doesn't mean that it makes other people happy, and vice versa. The fact is, I can become a bit belligerent on the subject of happiness." Then happily, it was time to head to the pizza table. One afternoon at the end of August, in a flash of insight, I managed to articulate a question that had long haunted me, just out of reach of my conscious mind. Am I ready? Years before, I'd written a law journal piece that argued that the law of torts is meant to comfort us in the face of the knowledge that something is going to happen. Suddenly, I grasped that my happiness projects were a different sort of attempt to master fate, to ensure that I was disciplined, organized, and well-rested, with my cell phone fully charged and medicine cabinet fully stocked, in order to meet some dreadful, nameless catastrophe. Something is going to happen. Am I ready? Whenever a calamity might strike, as surely it would, I wanted to be prepared and my new happiness project would help. I thought eagerly of the work I'd do to cull my possessions, to brace my relationships, to husband my time more wisely, and to behave myself better. The weather set a perfect mood as I walked through the neighborhood with my long list of back-to-school errands. The late summer air hung rich with fresh beginnings and new possibilities, with a cooler edge that hinted that winter was coming. There was no time to waste. Vacation was over, and the end was the beginning. September was here. The month of September. Possessions. Find a true simplicity. We need to project ourselves into the things around us. Myself is not confined to my body. It extends into all the things I have made and all the things around me. Without these things, I would not be myself. Carl Jung, C.G. Jung speaking. Resolutions. Cultivate a shrine. Go shelf by shelf. Read the manual. Once the season of the harvest, now the season of la rentrée, September has always been a milestone month for me, and this September had particular significance. After the first week of school, Eliza walked to school alone. Although she has a safe walk of just 9 blocks, we both were nervous the first time she left by herself. But after that morning, she was thrilled with her new independence. The change was bittersweet for me, because I would miss our time together. Oh well, I comforted myself. Eleanor was just starting kindergarten. I still had many years of morning walks ahead of me. Last May, at the end of nursery school, Eleanor had seemed so big, but in her new school, she was little all over again. As I led her into her classroom on that first morning, I loved seeing the construction paper decorations, the block area and the dress-up clothes, the rows of carefully labeled cubbies. Already, I felt deeply sentimental. When I considered how to be happier at home, I thought first of Eliza, Eleanor, and Jamie. The contents of my home and its architecture mattered much less than its occupants. But while home was the people in it, it was also the physical space and the objects that surrounded me there. I decided to start my happiness project with the theme of possessions, not because I thought possessions were the most important aspect of my home. They weren't, but because I knew that in many cases, my possessions blocked my view and weighed me down. Before I wrestled with deeper challenges that struck closer to my heart, in the months devoted to marriage, parenthood, and family, I wanted to feel more in control of stuff. My theme of possessions, however, wouldn't extend to furniture, wallpaper, bathroom tile, or any permanent aspect of the apartment. Although I knew that many people might be eager to address the home decor aspect of home, I'd never been interested in interior design, window treatments, kitchen countertops, or anything else. That is, until I read the haunting, evocative book, A Pattern Language. In it, visionary architect Christopher Alexander and his team identify 253 patterns that repeat through the architecture that people find most pleasing. As I read about these patterns, I began to fantasize for the first time about living in a dream house, one that incorporated patterns such as sleeping to the east, staircase as a stage, garden growing wild, the fire, and private terrace on the street. I wanted them all. But although Alexander's grand system of archetypes enthralled me, our current apartment either had elements such as window place or sunny counter, or, in most cases, it didn't. For this month of possessions, I would limit myself to the movable objects inside our apartment. Within the larger subject of happiness, the proper relationship of possessions to happiness is hotly debated. People often argue that possessions don't, or shouldn't, matter much to happiness. But I think they do. Some research suggests that spending money on an experience brings more happiness than buying a possession, but the line between possessions and experiences isn't always simple to draw. The latest pair of skis is tied to the fun of skiing, and a fashionable dress adds to the fun of meeting friends. A camera is a possession that helps keep happy memories vivid, a big happiness booster. A dog is a possession, an experience, a relationship. Also, many wonderful experiences require or are enhanced by possessions. Camping is easier with a great tent. Throwing a Halloween party is more fun with wonderful decorations. Choosing postcards enhances the pleasures of traveling. Part of the fun of fly fishing is picking out the equipment. Also, for many people, shopping itself is an enjoyable experience. Acquisition of possessions is part of the fun, but not all of the fun. People's desire for possessions can change over time. A friend told me, "For years, I loved the feeling that I could pack up my apartment in an afternoon, load it into my car, and drive away." Like that character in the movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape who said, "I just like having the one key," I said. Exactly. I felt so free. I could do anything, go anywhere. Do you still feel that way? "No," he said. "Over time, I've started to want to have more things. I'm still single, so I can live any way I want, but now I want to be settled someplace with my things around me." We often deny the importance of possessions or feel embarrassed by our enthusiasm for them, but the desire to possess has roots very deep in human nature. Although there are a few societies in which notions of ownership are absent or downplayed, observe researchers Gail Steckety and Randy Frost in Stuff, in most cultures, the interaction between people and their things is a central aspect of life. Of course, the practice of denying the importance of possessions is also ancient, and many cultures extol the principle of non-attachment and the relinquishment of worldly goods. It's certainly true that possessions, or the desire for possessions, can undermine happiness, and that some people are happier when they own very little. I once had a long conversation with a 23-year-old guy who tried to convince me how happy I'd be if only I would downsize to one backpack of stuff. "I can't tell you how much more serene I feel now that I've gotten rid of practically everything," he said earnestly. "It's the answer." "For you," I said with a laugh. "But it's not the answer for everyone." For me, I knew, possessions had a role to play. In fact, one of my goals for the month was to glean more happiness from my possessions. The fact is, attachment brings happiness, and attachment brings unhappiness. Love for people, for possessions, for a place, for an animal, for a house, for anything, exposes us to the pain of loss. It's inescapable. We can mitigate that pain by moderating or even eliminating attachment, but while something is gained, something is also relinquished. I wanted to love my possessions and yet not be mastered by them. In the persistent debate over the proper role of possessions in spending, I often heard the argument, "It's awful. People are so materialistic. They think that money and buying things can make them happy, but they can't." This statement contains more than one idea. The first idea is that money can't buy happiness. True. Money can't buy happiness, but spent wisely, it can buy things that contribute mightily to a happy life. People's most pressing worries include financial anxiety, health concerns, job insecurity, and having to do tiring and boring chores. And money can help to relieve these problems. Money can help us stay close to other people, which is perhaps the key to happiness. It can help us support causes we believe in. It can help us pursue activities that bring us happiness, whether raising children, planting a flower garden, or planning a vacation. The second idea is that people, not us or our friends, of course, but other people, are too materialistic. That is, they place too much importance on owning things and showing them off. True, people who are materialistic tend to have unrealistically high expectations of the power of material things, and they seek to define themselves, or raise their status, or make themselves happier through possessions. Studies show that highly materialistic people are less happy, though which is the cause and which is the consequence isn't clear. However, in some situations, behavior that might outwardly seem materialistic has a non-materialistic cause. Conspicuous consumption doesn't explain every flashy purchase. For instance, I have a friend who's always the first to buy the latest gizmo, not to show that he can afford it, but to feed his fascination with technology. Clothes are a puzzle. Some people appreciate beautiful clothes for their own sake. It's not all about making a display for other people, though that's part of it too. Virginia Woolf noted in her diary, "But I must remember to write about my clothes next time I have an impulse to write. My love of clothes interests me profoundly, only it is not love, and what it is, I must discover." Is this love purely materialistic? For better or worse, buying things, or photographing them, cataloging them, or writing reviews about them, is a way to engage with the world. When we're interested in something, we often express that interest by researching, shopping, buying, and collecting. People who love art go to museums, but when they can afford it, they usually want to buy art too. People who love to cook enjoy buying kitchen tools and exotic ingredients. The latest sports equipment probably isn't much different from what's already in the closet. We crave to buy and possess the things we love, even when it's not necessary. I'm interested in reading the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin only every so often, and my neighborhood library has 2 copies. Yet I want my own copy. When we possess things, we often want to show and share them with other people. Is that necessarily materialistic behavior? Many of the most precious possessions are valuable not because of their cost or prestige, but because of the meanings they contain. Modest trinkets, homemade objects, worn books, old photographs, whimsical collections. After someone's death, how strange to see the value drain away from his or her possessions. Useful household objects such as clothes or dish towels or personal papers become little more than trash. Because we often want to deny the importance of possessions, and because we don't want to seem materialistic, we often don't spend enough time and attention thinking about how possessions could boost happiness. Or at least, I didn't. My possessions had a powerful influence over the atmosphere of my home, and they contributed to and reflected my sense of identity. Was it possible to be happy with very few possessions? Yes. Were some people happier when they owned almost nothing? Yes. But for most people, including me, possessions, wisely chosen, could be a boon to happiness. Possessions have a role to play in happiness, yet it seemed as though every time I visited a bookstore, turned on the TV, or picked up a newspaper or magazine, I heard the message, "You'll be happier with less." Whenever I fell into conversation with people about the subject of happiness at home, I often heard the response, "Oh, I need to simplify." Some of the great minds in history urge us toward simplicity. Thoreau admonished, "Our life is frittered away by detail. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity." This longing for simplicity is so powerful and complex that it needs its own term. Much like nostalgie de la vue, which is yearning for the mud, or wabi-sabi, which is the beauty of the imperfect and the impermanent. When I asked on my blog if anyone knew a term to capture this idea, one reader coined the wonderful term Waldenlust. This longing takes several forms. Fantasies of the freedom that dispossession would bring, nostalgia for earlier, supposedly simpler times, and reverence for the primitive, which is assumed to be more authentic and closer to nature. I've often felt a yearning to escape from the ties of ownership. I've wanted to dump the entire contents of a chest of drawers into the trash rather than endure the headache of sorting the good from the bad. I often choose not to buy something useful or beautiful because I don't want the responsibility of another possession. Years ago, walking through a convenience store parking lot in some small, nameless California town, I had a sudden vision of abandoning everything, my possessions, relationships, ambition, to disappear unencumbered. What care I for my goose feather bed? I'm away with a raggle-taggle gypsy-zo. Sometimes, too, in an eerie dark reversal, I love something so much that I feel the urge to destroy it, to be free from that attachment and the fear of loss. I was so puzzled by this impulse that I wrote a book about it, Profane Waste. One friend had a particularly acute case of Waldenlust. he was headed to his parents' house to go through the 20 boxes he'd stored there. "It's terrible to say, but I really wish there'd be a fire or a flood," he said ruefully. "Then I'd be done. I hate the thought of dealing with all that stuff." "Why are you doing it?" "My parents are really annoyed. I promised I'd leave the boxes there just temporarily, but they've been there for a year now." "If you haven't needed anything for a year, maybe nothing's important," I said. "If you wish everything would get destroyed in a fire, maybe you could just throw the boxes away without going through them." "No, I couldn't do that," he shook his head. "I can't just throw it all away, even if I don't want it." I nodded. I understood the demands of those dusty cardboard boxes. Even though they sat neglected and unwanted, somehow they held pieces of himself, the past, that couldn't be discarded recklessly. In the past few years, I'd made great headway in conquering my own clutter, but I still wasn't free from it. The press of superfluous possessions made me feel unsettled and harried, and the demands required by acquisition, use, maintenance, storage, and even relinquishment ate up my energy and time. However, although I wanted to simplify, I also feared that I was too inclined to simplify. Of course, the virtues of simplicity lay far deeper than mere elimination. Yet I saw a danger in my craving. I didn't want to be tempted to cut away too much. The first principle of my happiness project was to be Gretchen. One important way to be Gretchen was not to assume that virtues that others strive to cultivate are the ones that I should strive for. Others strive to save. I push myself to spend out. Others try to work more. I try to play more. Others strive for simplicity. I fight the simplifying impulse because, if anything, I cultivate too much simplicity. Not a disciplined, thoughtful simplicity, but one created by indifference and neglect. There's a lassitude deep in my soul. I always have to fight my urge to do nothing. If I didn't have to consider Jamie and my daughters, if I didn't have my mother to coach me along, I'd be living in a studio with bare walls, crooked blinds, and a futon on the floor forever. For some, that simplicity would seem attractive and perhaps even admirable, but not to me. In my case, it would be the simplicity of evasion and apathy, not the simplicity of beautiful emptiness or voluntary poverty. I've always been this way. After I graduated from college, I lived in a house in Washington, D.C. with three friends. After the first year, one of my housemates said kindly, "The thing about living with you, Gretchen, is that you don't subtract and you don't add. You never leave a mess and you never bring home a dessert or call the cable guy." Which was so obviously true that it didn't even hurt my feelings. I was always telling myself, keep it simple. But as Albert Einstein pointed out, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. I was made happier by my decision to bring paper plates, not home-baked muffins, to Eleanor's start-of-school party. But keep it simple wasn't always the right response. Many things that boosted my happiness also added complexity to my life. Having children, learning to post videos to my website, going to an out-of-town wedding. Applied too broadly, my impulse to keep it simple would impoverish me. "Life is barren enough, surely, with all her trappings," warned Samuel Johnson. "Let us therefore be cautious how we strip her." When I asked a friend what things made her happy, she answered, "Dogs and fresh flowers." Dogs and fresh flowers? Two things I never brought into my apartment, despite their known happiness-boosting abilities. I didn't want a pet or houseplants. Too much work. I never looked forward to traveling. Too many details. I loved the idea of entertaining, but rarely did. Too much trouble. In my home, I wanted the peace of simplicity, of space and order, but I had to guard against my impulse to toss out every item in the refrigerator. I wanted the sense of ampleness and possibility, with beloved objects, plentiful supplies, and a luxuriant disarray. I would hold a place for that 60-year-old tin saltines box, just because I love its shape and colors. Cultivating my possessions, then, wasn't a simple matter of organization, elimination, or accumulation. It was a matter of engagement. When I felt engaged with my possessions, I felt enlivened by them. And when I felt disengaged from them, I felt burdened. My craving for simplicity was provoked not by a profusion of too many